This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez. And the morning run begins. It's the 5th of September. It is. I've almost forgotten the month. I've almost forgotten the date, considering we've had 5 days off. Brian, how was your very, very, very long weekend?
Very, very, very nice. Relaxing, exercise, eating, just chilling out.
Okay.
And how was yours?
Equally relaxing with far too many late nights, which made getting up this morning a hellish experience. And for all of those and all for all of you who've had a similar experience, you can always share it with us at BFM Radio, or you can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Now, because a lot of things have happened over the last 24 hours and especially in the last 12 hours, developments on the Korean Peninsula, Brian, of course, we've all, you know, had this the shadow of those missile launches, as well as the earthquake that in fact signaled an underground H-bomb or hydrogen bomb test.
And Sharad, that's one of the worrying things. Is I read an article which basically traced the chronology of North Korea's tests from 2006, and you can see that the capability of each test is increasing. And they've just got to, now I think it's above, the hydrogen bomb is above 10 kilotons. So three times more powerful than Nagasaki.
Yeah, it's very worrying. And I believe the UN, they're discussing action against North Korea, with the US pressing for the toughest possible sanctions against the state. Now, also South Korea says that it has evidence that North Korea is preparing more missile launches and possibly one using another intercontinental ballistic missile. Also in the news, on the Rohingya story, Al-Qaeda's Yemeni branch has called for attacks on Myanmar authorities. This goes following a deluge of news about thousands, literally about 70,000 refugees pouring in from the western state of Rakhine in Myanmar into Bangladesh. And so, you know, and this idea that Myanmar is carrying out a genocide against the Rohingya people, because a lot of other people caught into it in this mix, including Buddhists and Hindus. I think there was a particular story about a village of Hindus also attacked by the Myanmar military. Also in the news, royals are in the news, Brian. I don't know if you get excited by royal news, but a Japanese princess has decided to marry a commoner because his smile is like sunshine.
Well, I'm not a royalist follower, but there are a lot of people out there who follow not just the Japanese monarchy, but particularly the British monarchy. And we've got news on that front as well.
Yeah, and what we hear is that William's wife, whose name escapes me at this point in time, is pregnant with her third child. I don't know what in the line of succession where that child will be. Sixth, I'm told. It's a fifth, I'm told. I'm told so many different things this morning. But anyway, it's the important thing is that they are pregnant with children. Oh, Catherine, not just William's wife. She's actually got a name of her own. I believe she did art history, which puts her above most. Okay, also BRICS leaders start a three-day meet in Xiamen over the weekend. Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. All those countries. In fact, we're going to come back with more of that later on in the morning. Now we have Santana with Oye Como Va, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Brian Fernandez and myself, Sharad Kutin. Now we had, of course, sad news over the weekend as well. On Sunday, a guitarist and bassist and co-founder of the 1970s, a rock group, Steely Dan, passed away, Walter Beck, was responsible for some 40 million albums sold, with hits such as Reeling in the Years, Ricky Don't Lose That Number, and Deacon Blues. He was 67 years old, very young.
So were you a fan of Steely Dan?
No, not particularly.
Yeah, because I didn't hear about them until we were researching this piece. So,
because they were, I mean, I think they were always a well-known name. I mean, you know, I can't say I was a big fan, but I knew that they existed, as it were. you know. But anyway, so if you like to know more about Steely Dan, we of course have a show called Untitled, which I think has Uma Paganambike Pakin as well as Ezra Zayed, and they speak. You can in fact search that by typing in Aja by Steely Dan. Aja is spelled A-J-A. It's Untitled number 39. So that's there.
I'll go and check that out.
Yeah, learn something or two. Yeah. Okay, also, because coming off the long weekend, there's been a lot of talk about whether we have far too many public holidays. And because we started with two scheduled public holidays, that was going to be Thursday and Friday, and then, of course, plus the weekend. And then we had that unscheduled public holiday yesterday in honor of our athletes that, you know, did extraordinary feats of sporting prowess by winning more than the kind of aspired to number of medals. I think we had hoped to get 111 medals.
That's
we get
right.
over 140 gold medals by the end of the games.
But the thing is, see, I'm at two camps. On one hand, yeah, honoring the athletes is very, very important, but there are different ways to honor the athletes. Having public unscheduled public holidays is a great disruption to particularly businesses. Now, the unplanned public holiday, for example, for Monday, if you're in manufacturing, you've got orders to fulfill. You've got export. You can't go and tell your customer, oh, it's going to take three extra days because we've got a public holiday on Monday. That just is not on. They're going to shift their business elsewhere. For an employee, obviously, public holidays are great. But
It depends. You know, when I went to a supermarket over the weekend and I saw some Malaysians behind the counter, I said, oh, so, do you get double the pay? They said, no, we get triple pay for working over public holidays. But I don't think that's true of many foreign workers who are in, say, the food and beverage business, right? The F&Bs, which hire foreigners, don't necessarily give their foreign staff triple the pay.
No.
So I think when you have...
I seriously doubt that.
Right? Yeah, so when you have businesses that have come to become used to a labor force that doesn't have to be paid extra, then perhaps it's no skin off their nose.
That's true. But you see, it's also a issue of productivity. So apparently, according to the CEO of Top Glove, who is also the chairman of the Manufacturers Association, it costs per day something in the region of $1.5 billion to the economy. Right. So it's a tremendous cost to the economy. On the other hand, there is an argument in favor, in fact, of shorter work weeks. So companies like Google, like Apple, have experimented in various ways with shorter work weeks.
I mean, so what is the optimum kind of shorter work week? Would it be, a three-day week, a work week? Would it be, in which case you'd have a four-day weekend? Or would it be 4 days of work and then a three-day weekend, which kind of like almost levels up the weekends and the weekdays? I understand that, and one of the things that have been said about this issue is that the work doesn't actually get reduced no matter how short a week or work week you have. And so what happens is you're just doing much more work, but in a short amount of time. In fact, I think the calculation is that by working 5 8-hour shifts is equivalent to working 4 10-hour shifts. So would you think that's preferable, actually having 4 days where you work 10 hours rather than 5 days when you work 8 hours?
So I think it very much depends on the type of work that you do. If you're in a manufacturing type environment, you just work longer hours, it's factor input, and then there's a direct translation. But if you're in a creative industry, there's nothing to do with your work week, really. It's how productive you are. So you could be productive just working 3 days a week and doing the same amount of work. It really depends on the type of job that you actually do.
I can imagine, yeah. In fact, for some of us, you never really get to turn off, do you? I mean, you might be back home, but you're still, if you're a journalist or you work in the media, you're constantly having to, plug into all that information and assimilate it and take note of things that are happening. Because when you come back to work, it's not like you can pretend, 5 days has gone by and nothing happened in the world.
No, absolutely. Sharad, I mean, we were talking about, how nice it was to have a holiday. But the reality is, I can speak for myself. Every day, I was checking Bloomberg to just see what's happening and radiating news around the world.
After these messages, Red Hot Chili Peppers and Scar Tissue, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Red Hot Chili Peppers with Scar Tissue. One of my favorite bands from the early 90s, I believe, early 90s. 80s, mid 80s, late 80s.
Late 80s.
Okay, so much for dating musicians. Now, and I don't mean dating as in going out for a burger and fries and a movie. Well, speaking of burgers, Char Kway Teow Burger. Now, how's that actually sound to you? An idea, conceptually, is that something you give the thumbs up to, the thumbs down to,
so
Brian?
Here's the thing. I think we've got to broaden our horizons a little bit. In the burger business, I realized that there's a lot of innovation. People have been trying different things. So when I first looked at that, I said, hey.
No. Solar energy is innovation. I mean, sending, you know, tiny little satellites into, you know, that are a fraction of the cost of what it would be to send a huge set. I mean, that's innovation. I mean, a burger that's made out of
food preparation,
rice patties, I don't believe is innovation. Anyway, Brian, there is in fact news that there is a campaign to bring into reality the Char Kway Teow Burger. And this is to supersede the Nasi Lemak Burger, all of which sounds horrendous to me. But we spoke to an expert, Razif Hashim, who's the co-founder of Fungry TV. Fungry TV. Whether this move to turn foods into foods such as Nasi Lemak and Char Kway Teow into burgers is just a trend or reflective of changing palates.
Well, I think it's a bit of both. I find that the Char Kway Teow burger that we've created, it actually has the taste of a Char Kway Teow, yet it doesn't do things that a Char Kway Teow does. First of all, as my friend John from Time Out KL said, that it's now a handheld Char Kway Teow. And secondly, when you eat it, it doesn't fill you up as much. You know, like generally, you know, when you eat a Char Kway Teow, there's that feeling of like, oh, loathiness, you know, sometimes at the end of it because of the high fat content. But because there's bread in there, it actually sort of absorbs all that oil, and so you don't feel so loathy. So, you know, back to your question, I find that, you know, it definitely serves a purpose if you fuse it or you morph it into something else. But I would say a lot of it has to do with trend.
Okay, that was Razif Hashim, co-founder of Fungry TV, talking about this so-called innovation, a Char Kway Teow burger. I just think you should leave well alone. I mean, why fix something as wonderful as Char Kway Teow and try and fuse it with something as, you know, simple and maybe slightly banal as a burger?
But you see, Sharat, how do you get fusion food if you don't innovate? And this is what it is. Now, whether I would eat it or not is a different story. But
you speak with such conviction there.
No, but the thing is this. Exactly. I mean, we've got to try. I mean, I like to cook. And so you've got to try different things. I remember when I was in university, you know, years ago, I was
decades ago.
I was appalled when Americans used to put peanut butter on apples and eat them. And, you know, it was just bizarre to me, but it was great. It tasted great, and I started eating that.
Okay, but the idea, of course, I think for, you know, the larger companies that sell you the traditional burger, which is a beef patty sandwiched between two slices of bread or a bun, the idea is that, you know, they're constantly trying to give you something new. But maybe, you know, because, you know, there are things that never really have to change. I mean, the Kway Teow, you know, soup or fried, stir-fried or whatever it is, has been there forever, and people haven't lost interest in it. So why is it that people, the purveyors of these things called burgers and their large franchises, feel compelled to innovate on such a regular basis when, you know, when it comes to food, they're just staples, you know?
It's localization. So what happens is essentially, a burger is a Western concept. You've got a meat patty, you've got a particularly American thick meat patty, little bit of vegetables.
Made from pink slime, I believe.
Slime. But the thing is, gourmet burger is made from really high quality meat, ground and fashioned. So, I mean, that's where, you know, innovation here came in terms of then adding stuff on it. And so they're trying to localize this.
Okay, so I understand the localization thing. Yeah. And it's, in fact, quite quaint and, you know, almost, you know, I mean, it does please me as a native that they would want to localize something as, you know, as simple as the burger. But is it really necessary? And should we even be talking about it? I mean, it really is this something for the topic of, is it really a topic of conversation?
Well, the thing is, food in Malaysia is always a topic of conversation. So I find also with whenever these large chains, and we won't mention them because they're not paying BFM to advertise for them, whenever they come up with these new meal thingies, I will try one of these burgers. Oh, they have seasonal campaigns and stuff like that. And I would try them generally.
Because you feel that somehow you're getting something new.
Yeah.
Because the issue here is the char kway, kway teow burger really a new taste sensation? I mean, is it really?
It could be. Because so here's the thing. What he said was you the bread actually absorbs the oil. So I can imagine that it would be.
In the past, it would be your gut and your hips. Okay, coming up, the wallflowers and one headlight, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was The Strokes and Threat of Joy. I'm sure I couldn't with me, Brian Fernandez. Also, thank you to Izzat Rahim, who's tweeted in thanking us for Scar Tissue as well as One Headlight. So One Headlight was by the Wallflowers, Jacob Dylan, son of Bob Dylan, and of course, Scar Tissue by Red Hot Chili Peppers. Thank you for enjoying the music. Now, the question is before us, it's a major question, is, you know, how do we promote civilizational values? How do we promote civilized behavior? And what does it actually mean to talk about being civilized?
Absolutely, Sharad, because this article basically talks about what Malaysian Institute of Integrity's President Dato' Dr. Anis Yusal Yusof says that all civil society should educate the public to have civilized thinking to ensure development of democracy. Civilized thinking?
Well, okay, so let's say what was before civilization, as it were, right? So the idea would be anarchy, or it would be a lack of rule of law, perhaps the lack of a universal application of laws, arbitrariness, all kinds of things, right? You associate with the early kind of history of mankind as we built great empires. It was the rule of the strong man and blah, 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 right? So democracy is actually kind of moving into the very late part of human kind of history, just the last couple of hundred years, really, when we tried to promote the idea of universal suffrage, the idea of the rights of man. These are all kind of expressions that capture, I think, the essence of a kind of civilizational dialogue. The question is, you know, why is the Malaysian Institute of Integrity saying this is necessary? And is in any way Malaysia lacking on that score?
I think one of the things is, and given that it's been brought up by the Malaysian Institute of Integrity, is the fact that there isn't a fundamental awareness of basic integrity issues such as you cannot take money. Corruption is a bad thing. Because we've read many articles in the past of how young people now seem, unfortunately, because of poor role models at the highest levels, they seem to think it's fine to take money.
I mean, I don't know what you're insinuating, Brian, but as I understand, our, you know, leaders are men and women of utmost integrity. I think the issue really is at this point in time, you know, what can we do? Because I do think that kids in school, they get these lessons in civic consciousness and all that. So there's a lot, they probably even test that you can pass. You can pass a test in moral values. So it doesn't necessarily make you a moral person. And so there's a kind of a gap between, you know, the expression and the rhetoric of what is valued and the actual practice. And the question is, how do you get from one to the other? I mean, you're a father of a young child. And how do you make that work for your child? I mean, between, you know, the expression of those values and actual practice.
I think a lot of times if you want to do behavior modification or molding, you've got to then state something, try to steer that child in a certain direction, and then follow up with an action that they can actually see. So, for example, you need to look after the needs of others who are less fortunate. Now, you can keep drilling that into the child, but until you as a parent, for example, show the child these are various things that you can do to actually help the less fortunate. That child will never have a correlation in terms of rhetoric and reality. So in this case, for example, I think that these values need to be drummed into young people, even at university level, across their university
career.
Yeah,
but this is the thing, right? So this drumming into people, this exaltation to be good and do good seems to always be there. I mean, it's not like we haven't had this. It's not like we haven't had decades of these kinds of moral lessons and all that. And yet in the actual practice seems to be quite different because there is a level of cynicism, right? People kind of think, well, okay, I'll pass my moral exam by I'll get all the right answers. But, you know, when I go out in the world, what I know is valued is being rich and being powerful. And that's the thing that I'm going to, in fact, chase.
No, and that's unfortunately a byproduct of our materialistic society. So I think especially at the schools, which is where you can control things, up to university, you need to get young people involved in activities that help them understand that doing the right thing is the good thing. It's the right thing to do.
So it's very circular, right? Doing the right thing is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, but then the question is, you know, how do you get off this bandwagon of platitudes and cliches and actually get the practice going? And that's where I see us failing miserably over and over again. Because it's not like this is the first time somebody said that we have to have, you know, upstanding values and such.
So again, it's unfortunately symptomatic of the decline in values and in our society. We used to be, I think people had a higher moral standards, and today it's all about money.
Oh, really? Yes. They had higher moral standards right through the 20th century?
I think so.
Maybe. Okay, this is after the messages, we have The Beatles and Got to Get You Into My Life, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was The Beatles with Got to Get You Into My Life. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Brian Fernandez, and the morning run continues. It's coming up to 50 minutes past 6, and it's the 5th of September. Of course, over the weekend, Brian, we had a lot of news about the Rohingya crisis. We even had President Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey accusing the Myanmar government of genocide, also imploring the Bangladeshi government to let refugees through the border. The Bangladeshi government has been blocking refugees to the extent that they can, actually, because there's been a flood. Over 70,000 people have crossed the border. And he's also agreed to help pay for the upkeep of those refugees. So this man, who otherwise is quite a dictator and not a Democrat in his own country, jailing journalists and academics and really kind of seen as a deeply tyrannical figure, now reaching out in a very kind of humanistic gesture to the Rohingya. Paradoxical, because on the Burmese side of the story, we have Aung San Suu Kyi, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, who's now being vilified for being silent on the Rohingya problem, perhaps even more complicit in their oppression.
Well, this issue with Aung San Suu Kyi being silent about the repression is not a new issue. That's been really from the start. Now, I've been a big fan of hers from the past. And it really puzzled me. I was really alarmed by it. But really, I think one of the issues is also the fact that I believe that, or I think that it could be something to do with the fact that she wants to affect change for Myanmar and basically is handcuffed by the fact that she can't respond to this because she'll be thrown out by the generals.
Well, perhaps. I mean, I think there is that kind of political analysis. But the expectation, I think, that people have of winners of the Nobel Prize is that they act with a higher level of integrity, perhaps moral leadership. That's what is expected. And in fact, already there are calls for her to have the calls to the Nobel Committee to pull the prize that was given to her. And the Nobel Committee has in fact responded to this by saying, no, it won't do so. That in fact, and this was somebody who was part of the committee at the time in which Aung San Suu Kyi received the award, saying that we don't elect saints and we don't censure you know, laureates for their actions after we give them the award.
Yeah, and yes, you hold them to a higher standard, but it's for achievements of the past. It's not their current achievements or what they're going to do moving forward.
So then what is the use of this Nobel Peace Prize? I mean, what is it exactly trying to tell us about the world? And why do we give so much attention to the Nobel Prize if what it's doing is in effect just, you know, thanking somebody for work they've done in the past, and then they're not held to any kind of standard, really?
So I think if you go back to the past as well in the Middle East, when Shimon Peres, Yitzhak Rabin, and Yasser Arafat were given the Nobel Peace Prize for Middle East peace. There was a lot of protest on that. In fact, one of the members of the organizing Nobel Committee resigned because, after all, Yasser Arafat was seen to be a terrorist.
Well, for one side of the argument, the other side, of course, would see, you know, Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Rabin as being terrorists as well and leading a very repressive state. We, in fact, have in the past calls for Henry Kissinger to have his award taken back, and Barack Obama as well. Remember, Barack Obama very famously got his prize very early on in his presidency, before
yes.
he had actually achieved anything as President of the United States, all on the hope that he would be somebody better in terms of America's attitude towards the world, because he's very famous for being the architect, but at least the somebody who carried on with the drone policy that killed over 3,000 people. And, you know, the use of drones plus this, you know, image of a Nobel Peace Prize winner just doesn't sit well.
But Sharad, the drones and killing 3,000 people, I think, is minuscule in terms of the overall number of people killed in terms of all these conflicts.
Oh, so I see. I don't know. Yeah. I think one person is killed is one too many, thank you very much.
I think,
especially as a systematic policy. Yeah. The other thing, of course, is maybe the difference is when you give a prize to somebody like a Desmond Tutu, who's come out on the Rohingya issue, he's the bishop from South Africa, as opposed to and when you give a prize to somebody who's actually a leader of a nation, right? Then they're very different. So it's easier to be, as it were, a moral voice outside of power. But once you're inside of power, once you have to wield it and you have to govern, then you're going to make all kinds of trade-offs, don't you think?
No, absolutely. I think in this case, you've hit the nail on the head for Aung San. She's got to make the trade-off in terms
Aung San's a father, actually.
Yeah. Aung San Suu Kyi, sorry. In terms of what's best for the nation. And unfortunately, she must probably be very, very conflicted. I mean, I like to see the positive side of what she's doing. But she's looking after Myanmar as a whole, I think. So she's, because the alternative could be rollback of democracy in Myanmar.
Well, that may be, but what is democracy that she's promoting if it means that, you know, dozens of people are murdered and thousands are persecuted and, deprived of their livelihoods and their lives? I mean, I can't see how much of a trade-off that is. But as Pearl Jam suggests, let's all be a better man. BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez, and the morning run continues. It's coming up to 6 minutes past seven. It's the 5th of September. We have a great lineup for you this morning. But first, let's talk about some controversies that broke out over the weekend. And this includes a piece written by journalist Busu Lin, who's come under fire for criticizing a demonstration by Rohingya refugees in Kuala Lumpur that took place last week, on Tuesday, in fact, before we got into the long weekend. Now, this story has kind of developed partly because Busu Lin, because who used to work with Malaysian Insider and I believe now works with the Malay Mail Online, was also awarded, given a media award by Suhakam, the National Commission of Human Rights. There were people, detractors, though she had a lot of supporters as well, who said that she was right to point out that when refugees come to this country and they get, some form of protection here, they should play by our rules and respect the laws of the land.
I think in general, Sharad, if you look around the world, that's a general feeling. It's not just a Malaysian thing. You come to my country, you've got to respect, we're generous towards you, but don't infringe on our beliefs and our rights.
Okay, so the question was, in the case of the Rohingya who bused themselves to a point, I think it was near Ampang Park, and would plan to march to the Myanmar embassy, have they had done previously over the last couple of years when the march seemed to have been sanctioned and it was well managed. This time, it seemed to have caused a traffic snarl at that point and also seemed to have broken out into some level of violence and or at least they were agitated protesters. Now, this seems to have been something that some Malaysians took exception to, weren't very sympathetic, and thought to themselves, why is it that they're behaving so badly, and why is it that we should now continue to be sympathetic?
So here's the thing, Sharad, that we've got to divorce the two issues. I think Malaysians in general are probably very sympathetic to the cause. I think we all are.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but yeah.
But the disruption is what irked a lot of Malaysians.
Therefore, a lot of people were saying, well, you know, your desire for free traffic flow sort of outweighed the human rights concerns. So these are people who are coming from a country where their kith and kin are being murdered. There is a suggestion of genocide, and we are concerned more with whether we have a traffic jam or not. And after all, couldn't the police or the authorities in charge come in and manage the flow much better? I mean, it could have been that way, right? And
no, absolutely, it could have been that way. And again, we've got to just take it from a different perspective, not necessarily our own perspectives, but just to look at their side of the equation. People tend to see things in a very simplistic manner. You're coming here and causing trouble, lah. So, you know, why should you do this? We are helping you. So it's that sort of thinking that probably permeates, that's why this discussion took place.
I understand that you need to use that accent when putting my position across. But I do think there is something in what you're saying. It is a very intuitive response to the way in other people act. I mean, why should we both help you but also have to deal with your demands? You're making demands on us by asserting your rights. And I think that there are many ways in which Busulin's arguments in some of the pieces make that point, which is that we should be concerned first with Malaysians, and then when we have reached a certain level, then we can share our luxuries with others. But I think if you look internationally, our obligations are much more than that. If you look historically, we had the boat people from Vietnam, and Malaysia, I think, acquitted itself quite admirably in the case of the boat people coming from Vietnam, and also the refugees coming from the conflict in southern Philippines during the Marcos era in the 70s as well. And we took in those refugees and we provided shelter, and we did we fulfill our international obligations.
Yes, our track record is very good, and I'm sure many Vietnamese, for example, who Malaysia was a transit point at that time before they went off to the West, when they went off to Australia or they went off to the US and all to better lives, and some of them have done really, really well. We were quite generous.
Yeah, in fact,
not a very rich country at that point.
Yeah, and so it's, you know, if you look at something like Turkey's not very rich, but it's, you know, a country that's taken on hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees. I actually met Brian, you know, some years ago, a young man who's an art historian plus art practitioner, teaches at an Australian university, a branch of an Australian university in Ho Chi Minh City. And he was a child on Pulau Bidung. And I was thinking, you know, how great it is that our generosity meant that this child could live out their potential, right? And you think of that with every refugee. But I don't think we see that in those things. We don't see the potential in refugees. What we see is a burden.
Yeah, and this comes to another problem within the Malaysian context itself. We don't allow them to work. So how can they be productive and contribute to our society for us as hosts if we don't allow them to work?
Yeah,
they want to work. I'm sure it's a horrible existence to be in a refugee camp. But if they are allowed to work, they are allowed to contribute back to the society that's hosting them.
Yeah, there's also this other thing, you know, Brian. I think there's a way in which we talk about privileges. Privileges granted by the state, by governments, by civil society organizations, we as a group of citizens to non-citizens. But there's also a question of rights. And I think we're, as a people, quite averse to the talk of rights. We don't like it's very inconvenient, because once you suggest that even non-citizens have rights, then you're constrained. No, if you talk only of gratitude and what you can, you know, what privileges you grant to others, because they can always be taken back. Rights can't.
No, absolutely, because it's the way we not only think about refugees, but it's also the way we think about foreign workers, second class
denizens,
human beings. Yeah.
It's true. I mean, I think in many ways we don't think very deeply about it. Perhaps it's terrifying to consider that when you go to your favorite Indian restaurant or mama or something, that the guy working there in the 24/7 restaurant, you know, gets half a day off every 2 weeks and has nothing of a social life, and something that you would never accept as working conditions for yourself, but you would accept because you know at the back of your mind that without their super exploitation, you wouldn't be able to get your food so cheap.
No, absolutely. And you've got to look at it. You know, I always believe that we need to treat our foreign workers in particular and refugees right, because, you know, it's karma. It's going to come back to you one day.
Talking like a good Catholic. I mean, I think coming back to Sulin there, you know, and her position, and I believe that, you know, there's also been quite a bit of angst-ridden responses to her, some of it perhaps very unkind, perhaps also attacking her as a person. And that's unfortunate, too, because one of the things that we seem to find very difficult to do is to have, you know, kind of civilized and, a moderate kind of conversation with each other over differences, you know. And I think she's been vilified by many. At the same time, she's had her supporters. And I wonder how you take that conversation further. How do you engage with somebody like Sulin, who seems to be speaking for the broad mass of people whose liberal sentiments are not particularly deep and maybe not particularly coherent, as I see it?
Maybe she's just taking the view and trying to express things that perhaps was an alternative view, not necessarily something that she held dear to, but she was, again, she works for a newspaper. She's got to take a balanced view.
It should be a bit provocative. And you're right. I think that sometimes, especially those of us who kind of promote this kind of human rights perspective, we're not willing to take the other view. We always see it from the standpoint of the victim rather than those around the victims who have to endure some hardship as a consequence. If you think of if you remember that famous, refugee camp in Calais in France, you know, everybody was very sympathetic to the refugees, but that whole town and its life was disrupted. You know, suddenly thousands of strangers among what was a fairly close-knit community. And I remember when we talked to some journalists who had covered that issue, said, did anybody interview the townsfolk? I mean, how would they feel? And I think sometimes we do forget that. And I admit that sometimes in our insistence on the rights-based argument, you forget the context in which rights have to
be practiced. And Sharad, that Calais example is a very good one, because in that small town of Calais, really the disruption to the lives of the townspeople would have been absolutely significant.
Okay, we'll be back with more news analysis after this, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.